This is Audible.
Beacon Press Audio presents The End of Animal Farming, How Scientists, Entrepreneurs, and Activists Are Building an Animal-Free Food System by J.C. Reese. This audiobook is narrated by Tom Rivera. Published by Beacon Press Audio, 2018. This book is dedicated to ancient changemakers like Pythagoras, vegetarian and Greek philosopher, and Ashoka, animal advocate and Indian emperor, whose ripple effects plausibly did more good than anyone else's in the history of the world. Introduction. This is not a book about the problems of animal farming. Scores of compelling books, documentaries, news articles, and scientific papers have detailed the damage animal farming does to public health, agricultural workers, rural communities, the national economy, the global food supply, our air and water, and, of course, farmed animals. This is a book about exactly how we can solve those problems. So much has been written exposing and condemning the animal agriculture industry. The technology theorist Tom Chatfield listed eating meat and factory farming first in his predictions of what our descendants in centuries to come will deplore about today's society. Journalist Ezra Klein, author Steven Pinker, business magnate Richard Branson, science educator Bill Nye, and Indian politician Manekha Gandhi have all made similar forecasts, based primarily on concern for farmed animals. In 2017, the BBC even produced the mockumentary Carnage, based in the vegan world of 2067. It took a critical and humorous look at Britain's unpleasant history of eating animals. It might seem surprising that the plight of these neglected creatures, by numbers around 93% of farmed animals are chickens and fish, is so compelling an issue, given the fact that humans are still plagued by disease, oppression, war, racial and economic inequality, and other pressing social issues. However, even if we ignore the harms animal farming causes to humans, a bit of reflection exposes a compelling moral urgency. Consider these three facts. First, there are over 100 billion farmed animals alive at this moment, more than 10 times the number of humans. Second, over 99% in the U.S., of these animals live on industrial large-scale factory farms, enduring atrocious cruelty such as intense confinement in tiny cages, brutal mutilation and slaughter methods, and rampant disease and suffering from artificial breeding for excessive production of meat, dairy, and eggs. Third, today we have scientific consensus that these are sentient beings with the capacity to feel great joy and suffering. If we put these facts together, then we see animal farming as more than an abstract system of machinery and livestock. Animal farming is the moral catastrophe of one sentient being with a heartbreaking life story, plus another sentient being, plus another, plus another, plus another, more than 100 billion times. Historian Yuval Noah Harari, author of the book Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, and Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow, went so far as to suggest that animal farming is the worst crime in history. You might feel cautious about this opposition to all animal farming. If there's a small percentage of the animal agriculture industry that's not factory farming, shouldn't we support that segment instead of abolishing the whole thing? What's wrong with buying eggs from happy hens? I will share my views on this topic at length in Chapter 6, arguing that we should oppose all animal farming. But note that most of this book's arguments don't rely on that viewpoint. Food advocates of all viewpoints are still united against the vast majority of modern animal farming. And you could read the rest of this book as The End of Factory Farming with little issue. The future is brighter than you think. Some people dismiss the notion that animal farming could ever end, arguing that meat, eggs, and dairy are too deeply embedded in human society and human nature. To the contrary, humanity has already seen many similar transitions. With animals, we shifted from whale oil to petroleum to light our homes. We shifted from horse-drawn carriages to automobiles as the dominant mode of local transportation. We're currently seeing a major transition in circuses from animal-based to human-based entertainment. Outside of animal issues, we've seen dramatic changes in our relationships with other humans, many of whom have been treated with blatant insensitivity similar to what animals currently endure. The inhumane practices of child labor have been largely abolished. Women, people of color, the mentally disabled, and many other oppressed groups have seen radical shifts from being viewed as mere property or lesser citizens to being appreciated as individuals with their own rights, desires, and interests, though of course society still has a long way to go. In the specific domain of animal farming and vegetarianism, we've already seen a remarkable transition that suggests that species differences like racial and gender divisions between humans are not unbreakable barriers to moral consideration. What's more, our dietary habits are not set in stone or hardwired into humanity. They are more determined by cultural mores. In the West, vegetarianism was for centuries seen as a strange puritanical lifestyle. In the 1800s, Sylvester Graham and John Harvey Kellogg, a minister and doctor, now best known for their crackers and breakfast cereal, respectively, advocated a bland vegetarian diet to improve health and reduce sexual desire and immoral tendencies. Other recommendations included vibration therapy, complete abstinence from alcohol and tobacco, and frequent enemas. While this made vegetarianism popular with the most ascetic and health-crazed segment of the population, it locked vegetarianism into the U.S. public consciousness as a fringe diet for the self-righteous and holier-than-thou. Modern vegetarian and vegan diets retain remnants of this stereotype, but they are taken far more seriously today because they are adopted not for personal purity, but for the sake of animals, the environment, and human welfare. When a startup called Memphis Meats released the world's first cultured meatball in 2016, real meat made with animal cells grown in cell culture, details in Chapter 5, the company announced plans to launch its products at barbecue restaurants in the Memphis area, appealing directly to the most carnivorous demographics. World-class athletes like mixed martial artist Nate Diaz, strongman Patrick Baboumian, tennis players Serena and Venus Williams, and NFL defensive end David Carter are all vegan, and they credit their vegan diets with enhancing athletic performance. Animal-free foods are increasingly associated with exciting new technology, Silicon Valley, and intellectual trendsetters. Consider the role of a single company, Google. Google's co-founder, Sergey Brin, funded the creation of the world's first cell-cultured hamburger in 2013. In 2015, Google tried to buy one of the leading plant-based food companies, Impossible Foods, though Impossible wasn't willing to sell. Eric Schmidt, the chairman of Alphabet, Google's parent company, listed nerds over cattle as the most important tech trend in 2016. He said animal-free foods would take over the conventional meat industry in the coming decades. Even internally, Google has been an early adopter of this trend in its employee cafeterias, replacing animal-based products with animal-free foods such as Just Mayo, a popular brand of eggless mayonnaise, and New Wave Foods' plant-based shrimp, which is made from the same algae that marine shrimp eat. The ace in the hole for the inevitability of the end of animal farming is the incredible inefficiency of making meat, dairy, and eggs from animals. Farmed animals consume calories and nutrients from plants, and they use that energy to do a lot more than produce meat, dairy, and eggs. They have all the normal bodily functions like breathing, movement, and growing byproducts like hoofs, organs, and hair. These processes mean farmed animals have a caloric conversion ratio of 10 to 1 or more. For every 10 calories of food we feed them, we get only about 1 calorie of meat in return. And for every 10 grams of plant-based protein, we get at most 2 grams of animal-based protein. Culinary professionals and food scientists are increasingly cutting this waste by taking the constituents of animal products, fats, proteins, nutrients, water, directly from plants and assembling them into the architecture of meat. They can also make cultured meat, like the Memphis Meats meatball, real animal flesh made by using cell cultures to grow meat in the same process that happens inside an animal's body. So it's molecularly identical to conventional meat. The efficiency of both these processes suggests that, in the long run, humanity will use its technological prowess to make meat, dairy, and eggs directly, without the wasteful process of raising and killing animals, regardless of ethics. To put it another way, a big reason we're going to see the end of animal farming is that it doesn't have to mean the end of meat. Effective altruism. My personal perspective in writing this book begins with growing up in rural Texas. The first time I saw a goat give birth is imprinted in my memory. It was a bloody ordeal, and all the neighbors circled around. They gathered to ensure that the mother was safe, to ensure the kid was healthy, and frankly, because there just wasn't that much else to get excited about in the woods of rural East Texas. In middle school, I made a goat exerciser for the science fair. My classmate and I assembled PVC pipes into a merry-go-round and leashed a goat to each side so they could walk in circles together. At other times in my childhood, I helped raise chickens and rabbits, competed in the county fair, and grew my own patch of watermelons and okra in a forest clearing behind the house my dad built himself in true Texas fashion. Like many American kids, I was also raised with coloring books that showed happy, healthy farmed cows, pigs, and chickens on green grass under a blue sky. I believed that animal agriculture was a decentralized industry composed of thousands of old MacDonald farms dotting the landscapes of rural America. Every day on my way to school, I passed by dozens of cows lounging on lush pastures, chewing grass and cud. To me, meat was an embodiment of the natural pristine connection between animals and humans who lived off the land. One day, when I was 14, I found a website describing the cruelties endured on the standard factory farm, such as that the average chicken is afforded less space than a sheet of printer paper. I found out that most of the meat I ate was from these farms, not the farms I saw on the roadside. So I put two and two together and went vegetarian on the spot. My reasoning for that decision was based on taking action that results in the greatest positive impact, a philosophy now known as effective altruism. We've seen a social movement emerge based on this philosophy, where the community applies evidence and reason to benefit others to the greatest extent possible. In fact, every research question in this book is motivated by the ultimate question of how we can do the most good. In high school and college, my interests were centered on the other social issues effective altruists prioritize, like fighting malaria and ensuring the safety of dangerous technologies like nuclear weapons and artificial intelligence. However, a central tenet of the effective altruism mindset is to stay open-minded and keep an eye out for the so-called cause X, a new way of doing good that could be even better than your current strategy. Eventually, I became convinced that reforming the food system was my cause X, based on three criteria: its scale, tractability, and neglectedness. Since then, I've committed my career to applying the lens of effective altruism to the issue of animal farming. I'm a participant observer who sees my role in social movements as supplying other advocates with the tools they need to succeed. I see this book as a roadmap for the farmed animal movement to improve the food system as quickly and reliably as possible. This book outlines the successful strategies already being implemented by movement forerunners and sketches a path forward based on careful analysis of their work, as well as evidence from fields such as history, psychology, sociology, and marketing. The most basic argument of this book is that we can take the scientific approach used in fields like medicine and apply it to social change. We can diagnose a social movement, assess its strengths and weaknesses, and prescribe evidence-based solutions. If you are already a part of the movement, I hope this book will show you a path toward the brighter future you desire. If you have yet to join, I hope this book will inspire you to take up arms, whether in your everyday life as a thoughtful consumer and citizen, or in the work you do as an activist, entrepreneur, or scientist. In either case, I hope that the evidence in this book will change your mind in some important ways, just as writing it has changed mine. One of the most useful skills advocates can develop is a sincere satisfaction in changing their mind, putting the goal of effectiveness before the goal of having been correct. As humanity's power grows, it will become increasingly important that humanity considers the interests of all sentient beings, not just those who can vote or organize on their own behalf, and that we approach complex social issues like animal farming with a perspective of effective altruism. The moral arc of the universe bends toward justice, but only if people like us take hold. Sketching out the roadmap. In the first two chapters of this book, I will outline a history of humanity's expanding moral circle and the current state of the farmed animal movement. These chapters address how humans have come to think of animals as sentient beings with their own desires and interests, how this has led to an unstable dissonance between our values and the state of our food system, which advocacy strategies have been most successful so far, such as the exposure of rampant animal cruelty through undercover investigations, and two popular advocacy strategies that I believe have been woefully counterproductive. The third and fourth chapters examine the history and limited success of currently available animal-free foods, such as the classic tofurkey holiday dish and the recent so-called bleeding veggie burgers that fool blind taste testers. These chapters tell the complicated stories of industry leaders who have one foot in activism and the other in running a competitive business. I will tackle strategic issues like the risk of corporate interests co-opting the farmed animal movement, which sort of food companies can make the biggest difference in our food system, and how we should label these foods. Should we call it meat if there's no animal slaughter? The fifth chapter is a deep dive into the new cellular agriculture industry where meat, dairy, and eggs are grown with cell cultures instead of produced via the raising and killing of animals. This industry promises to deliver not just plant-based versions that fool blind taste testers, but actual animal products that are molecularly identical to animal flesh. I will introduce the scientists and business leaders behind this new technology, examining which strategies they can utilize to maximize its impact. An animal-free food system depends not on technology alone, but also on changing hearts and minds. Chapters 6, 7, and 8 lay out the key strategies of activism and social change that will beckon the animal-free food system. Chapter 6 looks at why people eat animal-based foods and proposes strategies that overcome each justification, especially the notion that animal-based foods are natural. This chapter also addresses the issue of so-called humane animal farming, arguing that the movement needs to oppose even the animal farms that, when considered individually, seem morally acceptable. Chapter 7 tackles changing our food system on a society-wide scale, arguing for institutional over individual change, focusing on the how of animal-free food over the why, putting stories before statistics, and maintaining a cautious approach to the use of confrontation. Chapter 8 zooms in on one crucial big-picture issue. Given the way vegetarian and vegan diets are currently perceived as the personal choice of white, wealthy Western liberals, how can we transition into a global, cross-cultural mass movement? Finally, Chapter 9 zooms out to the broader context of humanity's moral circle, speculating on what the end of animal farming will look like, when it will happen, what it will mean for human-animal relationships, and what struggles sentient beings will face after the end of animal farming. I'll discuss the psychological tension advocates face between everyday struggles and the society-wide, centuries-long fight to expand the moral circle. Advocates need to keep an eye to the far future, positioning their ideological descendants to have the best shot at finally achieving a safe, just future for all sentient beings. 1. The Expanding Moral Circle. In 2015, some friends and I visited a small, picturesque farmhouse in California's San Joaquin Valley, surrounded by never-ending vineyards stretched under an open sky. We drove down a rocky, winding road to the metal gate at the front of the property. Our host, Christine, greeted us in a golf cart packed with rakes, trash bins, and other maintenance supplies. Christine is a cheerful, down-to-earth woman with a big smile who earned her degree in poultry science from Texas A&M, an agriculture and engineering-focused university an hour away from my hometown in rural Texas. But Christine isn't a farmer or rancher. She manages Harvest Home Animal Sanctuary, a nonprofit organization that rescues and cares for abused animals, mostly chickens, turkeys, goats, ducks, and pigs. Farm sanctuaries like hers provide lifelong care for a few fortunate animals, educate the public, and build the advocacy community through volunteer opportunities that give people a direct connection to the animals these organizations are trying to protect. At the gate, Christine welcomed us with a beaming smile and suggested we park in the dusty clearing in front of the house centered on the property. To the left of the driveway was a dark, hay-filled pig barn where several porcine residents wagged their tails next to the fence, eager to sniff and oink at the new visitors. To my right was a small open shelter in the middle of a large grassy field with goats, chickens, and a couple of outspoken turkeys. The first resident I met, who ambushes every visitor, was boyfriend Ben, a broad-breasted bronze turkey. Ben shuffled back and forth in front of me with his feathers extended outwards in a "look at how big I am" mating dance. He single-mindedly shuffled next to me for my entire visit, even trying to stay in my field of vision when I turned away. I tried to understand this behavior by comparing it to a man constantly flexing his muscles, but I'm not sure if I can fit the turkey-shaped peg into a human-shaped hole. In the backyard of the farmhouse, I met Ray, a special-needs goose. Ray is blind and suffers from angel wings, in which the last joint of the wing is fixed outwards, a condition common in domestic fowl, caused by poor diet such as the overconsumption of bread. This takes away the bird's ability to fly and even makes walking difficult. I imagine it must be like having to carry a sideways 2x4 that keeps bumping into things and throwing you off balance, though surely this human-animal comparison is also imperfect. Ray has an insatiable curiosity that makes the pejorative bird-brained less applicable than brainy bird. Ray especially loves splashing around in her kiddie pool and draping her neck around friendly humans. After a few more introductions to the locals, I got to work. Harvest Home hosts monthly tours where you can lounge about and relax all day, but it's better to go there as a volunteer. For animal advocates hoping to recharge, the best experience comes from taking an active role in the animal's healing process, seeing the stark differences in health and behavior between newcomers and longtime residents. Doing so gives you a deeper appreciation of who they are and what they've been through. At the last barn I cleaned, I met Hayden, a rowdy young pig who's always first to the fence when visitors arrive. He's actually a Yucatan mini pig, raised to mature quickly and stay much smaller than wild or farmed pigs. Yucatans are favored in biomedical research for these features and because they are so docile and trusting, much like beagles, the most common dog breed used for research. Hayden was used for skin testing because of his hairlessness and his skin's biological similarity to that of humans. I don't know exactly what kind of skin research he was used for, but to be honest, I don't need to know. The burn marks and scars covering his body tell me enough. While cleaning the pig barn, I carried used hay away in trash bins. Once, while I was carrying two bins this way, Hayden trotted along behind me. I set one bin down so I could empty the other onto the compost heap. While I had my back turned, Hayden pushed his body into the bin I set down, causing it to topple over. I appreciated the assistance, but he wasn't doing it for me. For the rest of the afternoon, he dug in the hay from that bin, snorting and wagging his tail vigorously. I'm still not sure what he was looking for. Perhaps an egg left over from cleaning the chicken barn. Or perhaps the satisfaction of emptying a bin on his own. But I felt immensely grateful to Christine that this troublemaker had the opportunity to do whatever it was he wanted to do. As ambassadors for their species, animals like Hayden give you a visceral appreciation of their capacity to have meaningful experiences of pleasure and suffering. Combine this understanding with the knowledge of the cruelty these animals endure in farms and slaughterhouses, as well as secondary concerns of sustainability, antibiotic resistance, the treatment of slaughterhouse workers, and numerous other issues, and it's easy to understand why an entire social movement has emerged working toward an animal-free food system. But to understand the momentum and timing of the modern movement, we must first understand the historical trajectory of humanity's concern for animals. Animal machines. In the 17th century, renowned philosopher René Descartes wrote that all non-human animals, including dogs, cats, and pigs, completely lack the ability to feel pleasure and suffering. Some historians believe Descartes held a more nuanced view, that animals have the mechanical ability to feel, but they lack true consciousness of those feelings. But in either case, the father of modern Western philosophy brutally illustrated his perspective when he nailed living dogs to wooden boards and hacked them to pieces. He used this experiment as evidence for his cruel philosophy, having found no evidence of a soul inside the poor dogs' bodies. The proposition of animal consciousness, although treated as common sense by many of us today, is an inherently challenging concept. It threatens our human need to feel unique in the world. The idea that humans are on top of the ladder of nature dates back to the Greek philosophers Plato and Aristotle, who believed in a natural linear order to the world. Humans sit comfortably above all animals and plants, surpassed only by angels and other heavenly beings. If Greek philosophers rejected this model and accepted that animals matter like we do, that would spark a number of pressing uncomfortable questions. If animals are just complex machines like printers or cell phones, does that mean we are too? When we see animals die, does that prove our own mortality? And if their lives consist of simple sustenance and reproduction, can we hope for something more? These existential difficulties contributed to the mistreatment of animals in more dire ways than the rhetoric of philosophers. In ancient Rome, humans frequently fought animals in combat, either as a form of capital punishment or as entertainment. For the opening of the Colosseum in AD 80, up to 9,000 animals from hares to elephants were killed in a 100-day celebration. Other historical practices seem even more sadistic and absurd, such as bear baiting, tying a bear to a post and commanding a number of dogs to attack him, and cat burning, hoisting live cats onto a bonfire in a public spectacle, both of which have been popular forms of entertainment in human history. These public acts of animal cruelty would be absurd, even terrifying, in much of modern society. Modern concern for animals is widespread. In 2015, animal rights had the highest support of any cause on the popular petition website change.org. A Gallup poll in the same year indicated that 32% of Americans believed animals deserve the exact same rights as people to be free from harm and exploitation. Another 62% believed they deserve some protection. Only 3% thought they don't need much protection. As of 2014, all 50 U.S. states have felony provisions for animal cruelty. This is a far cry from Descartes' view that animals deserve zero protection. The change in attitudes with respect to animals is of the utmost importance for understanding the future of food. Most animal products today come from factory farms, industrial facilities brimming with blatant abuse. Many pigs are kept in crates so small they can't turn around. Fish often die by being crushed or suffocated out of water. Hens lay supersized eggs almost daily, leading to a host of health issues and chronic pain, and they live in tight cages for virtually their entire lives. Some argue that these practices are just the way things are. They say that society has grown to recognize human equality across gender, race, and nationality, but non-human animals are too distant and different to receive our full moral consideration. We see it in our everyday language when we use it to refer to animals in the same way we'd refer to an inanimate object. When we use expressions like, more than one way to skin a cat, without a second thought. I understand this skepticism, but in the rest of this chapter I will argue that a variety of social forces, especially the scientific recognition of animals as conscious, feeling beings, have created a wide and unstable gulf between humanity's treatment of animals and the belief that animals deserve our protection. Nowhere is this disconnect more severe than our food system, but we will see that the expanding moral circle has eradicated animal cruelty in a wide range of industries and is already banging on the locked doors of factory farms. The Scientific Revolution. The Scientific Revolution kicked off in 1543 with the publication of On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spheres, in which the astronomer Nicolaus Copernicus argued that the sun, not the earth, was the center of celestial orbits, a theory that deeply contradicted the earth-centric religious doctrine of the time. Copernicus used years of astronomical data to compare the heliocentric and geocentric theories. He determined that the heliocentric model was more consistent with the evidence. If the sun were at the center of the solar system, the appearance of retrograde motion, the apparent backtracking of planets across the night sky sometimes of the year, could be explained with simple oval-shaped orbits. If the Earth were centered, there would have to be small loops awkwardly inserted into planetary orbits, making it a much less plausible theory. This reasoning is an example of parsimony, a scientific rule of thumb that says when we have competing theories that explain our data and evidence equally well, we should select the simplest explanation. With Copernicus and the Scientific Revolution, parsimony became a hallmark of modern critical thinking. This heuristic is useful across all areas of decision-making, and you've probably used it yourself without realizing it. In medicine, there's an aphorism. When you hear hoofbeats, think of horses, not zebras. It reminds doctors not to come up with a strange, unusual diagnosis for a patient when a more common one would explain the same symptoms. Parsimony can just as easily be applied to our understanding of animal minds. As we've accumulated more and more evidence that animals behave like us and even share our neuroanatomy, the simplest explanation is that they are conscious in much the same way we are. If they jump when startled, they probably feel fear. If a puppy rolls over in front of you for a belly scratch, your scratches probably bring her joy. If it walks like a duck. 13 years after the publication of On the Origin of Species, the book that popularized the theory of natural selection, Charles Darwin wrote The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals. He discussed the remarkable similarities among animals, including humans, in their emotional behavior. He writes about the smiling of dogs, the way they show affection like we do, and describes taking his own dog on a walk. He recounts the human-like fidgety excitement or dejection the dog expressed based on whether Darwin took the right or left fork in a familiar path. To Darwin, this indicated an emotional understanding of the destination signaled by each direction. Scientists have even found behavioral evidence of altruism and empathy, two mental capacities long thought to be out of reach for non-human animals. For example, elephants will help each other when injured, such as by removing tranquilizer darts and sharp branches. They console nearby anxious elephants by touching them and making soft vocalizations. In laboratory tests, a rat will choose to help a drowning companion over selfishly receiving a tasty piece of chocolate. Even animals we normally think of as less intelligent have demonstrated remarkable mental capacities. Pigs, for example, have been shown to do much more than snort and roll around in the mud. They form mental categories of different objects in their environment, store long-term memories of their experiences, and even take the perspectives of other pigs. A group of German scientists gave pigs individual names and were able to train them to stand in line and walk up to a feeding station when their names were called. Let's look closely at the example of grief, a complex emotion many would say only humans can experience. In humans, grief can manifest itself in a number of ways, but it's classically organized into five stages: denial and isolation, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Individual humans might experience some of these stages or none. Can animals experience any? As with most complex animal behaviors, the answer is yes, in their own way. Scientists have focused on grief behavior in elephants due to their charisma and apparent intelligence. Elephants touch and caress the remains of family members and place branches and vegetation on the corpses. They treat the site of death differently than other places. When passing through, even years later, they'll sometimes pause in the location for several minutes. In farmed animals, grief is an inherent component of modern dairy practices. Neuroscientist Oliver Sacks once accompanied the animal behaviorist Temple Grandin to a dairy farm. Sacks recalls, "When we arrived, we could hear a great tumult of bellowing. They must have separated the calves from the cows this morning," Temple said, and indeed, this was what happened. "We saw one cow outside the stockade, roaming, looking for her calf and bellowing." "That's not a happy cow," Temple said. "That's one sad, unhappy, upset cow. She wants her baby, bellowing for it, hunting for it. She'll forget for a while, then start again. It's like grieving, mourning. Not much written about it. People don't like to allow them thoughts or feelings." Without real evidence to the contrary, we shouldn't assume that only mammals or even vertebrates have sophisticated mental capacities like grief. For example, tool use, once thought of as a defining characteristic of humans, or at least primates, has now been recorded in a wide variety of animals. A viral YouTube video even shows an octopus carrying a coconut shell across the ocean floor, then enclosing himself within it, creating a bit of shelter in an otherwise barren environment. Octopuses also stack rocks at the openings of their homes to keep out predators. Darwin himself went so far as to argue for consciousness in worms, suggesting that they might have at least the most basic level of sentience. When a worm is suddenly illuminated and dashes like a rabbit into its burrow, to use the expression employed by a friend, we are at first led to look at the action as a reflex one. He goes on to explain that the worm, despite our intuitions, shows behavioral complexity similar to our own, learning and adapting its behavior. He suggests that worms have a spotlight of awareness like we do, shifting their attention depending on the situation. The founder of modern biology concludes that the comparison here implied between the actions of one of the higher animals and of one so low in the scale as an earthworm may appear far-fetched, for we thus attribute to the worm attention and some mental power. Nevertheless, I can see no reason to doubt the justice of the comparison. People used to be more skeptical of this sort of evidence, saying that even if animals show complex perception and behavior, We have no way of truly knowing that these behaviors are based in consciousness instead of another mental mechanism. This is known as the problem of other minds in philosophy, and it's a tenable philosophical position. But moral action doesn't require certainty. In this case, the simplest explanation is that animals who display behaviors that are driven by consciousness in humans most likely have a similar sort of consciousness. To apply parsimony to this situation, we could use the popular saying, if it walks like a duck, swims like a duck, and quacks like a duck, then it probably is a duck. Scientific consensus. Over the past few decades, this reasoning has gained major traction in the scientific community, overcoming the Cartesian notion of animals as unfeeling machines. In 1970, scientists began to track killer whales, or orcas, off the coast of British Columbia in Canada and Washington in the U.S. They discovered that individual whales could be identified with a single photograph of their dorsal fin and upper surface due to variations in tears, skin colorings, and other features. This allowed researchers to track individual whales for the first time, which illuminated the rich social lives of these creatures in matriarchal pods and, as an indication of how little attention we gave them before, led to the discovery that there are two distinct species of orcas in the Pacific Northwest. Researchers in this era, who drew the obvious conclusion from these results that orcas were social creatures with complex auditory communication and emotions, were heavily criticized. Raising the profile of whales seemed to threaten the anthropocentric perspective that humans were special in their mental capacities, a viewpoint bolstered by the hunters and business people who exploited these creatures for display and entertainment. In 1976, animal behaviorist Donald Griffin published a book titled The Question of Animal Awareness and received widespread dismissal for even addressing the topic, despite having established himself as a scientific leader with his monumental discovery of echolocation in bats. Today, primatologist Franz de Waal refers to animal cognition as a term considered an oxymoron until well into the 1980s. In 1992, biological psychologist Sonia Jorg still warned young researchers that animal cognition isn't a project I'd recommend to anyone without tenure. And even in 1995, author Geoffrey Masson wrote in his seminal work, When Elephants Weep, there is a tremendous gap between the common sense viewpoint and that of official science on this subject, suggesting that while the layperson agreed with animal consciousness, scientists were still behind the curve. It wasn't until the 21st century that the majority opinion finally shifted. In 2010, psychologist Hal Herzog wrote that 153 of 155 scientists surveyed said that animals could have the conscious experience of pain. In 2012, a number of leading neuroscientists made a definitive statement on the issue with the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness, noting that the weight of evidence indicates that humans are not unique in possessing the neurological substrates that generate consciousness. Today, this new scientific awareness is helping research on the details of animal consciousness flourish. New, fascinating studies are published every year. In 2013, the New York Times ran a piece by the psychologist Gregory Burns, Dogs Are People Too, describing his research. Burns trained dogs to enter a functional magnetic resonance imaging scanner so he could look inside their brains. Unsurprisingly, he found patterns of activity very similar to those of humans. Although this research is just beginning, Burns called the personhood of dogs his inescapable conclusion. This surprisingly recent timeline roughly traces the scientific community's progress away from its dark past, away from the desperate need for human superiority that masqueraded as scientific skepticism. No longer is it standard, or even appropriate, to respond to the evidence of animal consciousness with sweeping dismissals like, well, yes, those behaviors seem consistent with consciousness, but we can't really know that's what's going on, so it's anthropomorphic and inappropriate to suggest these animals are actually conscious. Members of the scientific community who took this Cartesian view in the past are either changing their minds or moving to the sidelines. I imagine this is causing them to feel somewhat embarrassed. Then again, even if their behavior seems consistent with feelings of embarrassment, we can't really know, can we? Popular science. The newfound scientific consensus contributed to the success of Blackfish, a 2013 documentary that led to commercial disaster for the animal theme park, SeaWorld. The film centered on the story of Tillicum, one of the park's orcas. Tillicum was captured in 1983 near Iceland and transferred to an aquarium in Canada. The young male was confined in a small pool with two older females, leading to significant aggression against Tillicum. Trainers temporarily moved Tillicum into a medical tank on his own, which was even smaller than the already tiny group enclosure. Orcas are highly social creatures who can roam up to 160 kilometers a day in the wild, so he was eventually returned to his previous enclosure, which didn't bode well for his psychological well-being. At one point in 1991, when Tillicum was in the pool with the two dominant females, a trainer slipped into the pool, and the three whales grabbed and dragged her beneath the surface, forcing her away from a life ring thrown by a bystander, and drowning her. 7 years later, after Tillicum had been transferred to SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida, a man who had stayed at the park after closing entered Tillicum's tank for unknown reasons. He was found dead the next morning. Finally, in 2010, Tillicum grabbed another trainer and pulled her under the water, leading her to die from drowning and blunt force trauma. Blackfish premiered at the 2013 Sundance Film Festival, and with its testimony from animal behaviorists and SeaWorld employees, made the case that Tillicum's tragic story was only one example of the larger issue of holding any orca in captivity. SeaWorld responded in full force, even creating a new section on its website to address the film, and subsequent backlash fueled further public attention and concern. Although the impact of Blackfish wasn't apparent during its early 2013 premiere, the debate and later airing on CNN prompted a national outcry that continues to this day. SeaWorld's net income dropped 84% from the second quarter of 2014 to the second quarter of 2015. Much of the uproar focused on the rich mental lives of the whales, suggesting that the success of Blackfish culminated decades of research and advocacy for treating animals as morally important individuals. In January 2017, Tillicum passed away after contracting pneumonia, prompting yet another round of outrage at SeaWorld and marine animal confinement. The scientific consensus has also contributed to the work of the Non-Human Rights Project, NHRP, an organization pushing for the recognition of legal personhood for animals, meaning that at least some of them would have the ability to be a plaintiff in court when their rights are violated. Of course, they would have human advocates filing suit on their behalf. NHRP's legal case is based on the best scientific findings on genetics, intelligence, emotions, and social lives of these animals, showing they are self-aware, autonomous beings. One of the NHRP's cases broke new ground on April 20, 2015, when a New York judge issued an order to show cause and writ of habeas corpus on behalf of the chimpanzees Hercules and Leo, who were being held at a medical research facility. This meant that their owner, the State University of New York at Stony Brook, was required to provide legal justification for the decision to keep them captive. The judge eventually dismissed the case, but not because she thought the arguments lacked merit. She felt that her court did not have the authority to make a decision in favor of Hercules and Leo because of the potentially groundbreaking legal ramifications. Despite the dismissal, the university stated that it would no longer conduct scientific studies on Hercules or Leo, and the NHRP entered negotiations to move the chimpanzees to an appropriate sanctuary. Social forces. Scientific opinion affects and is affected by public opinion. But other social factors could help explain humanity's increasing concern for animals. I'll touch on a few of the most interesting ones here because they help us understand how the moral circle will expand in the future, especially in what ways it might reach animals raised for food. Urbanization and pet ownership. In the past few centuries, humanity has moved en masse from farms and rural areas to city jobs and urban areas. This migration has been accompanied by a breakdown of traditional social structures. Frequent contact with relatives and tight-knit communities has given way to smaller families and more social isolation. These two factors are correlated with increased pet ownership. As wealth increased and horses made way for cars, city dwellers may have owned pets to show off their wealth or to fill the emotional gaps left by a lack of working animals, relatives, and close friends in the city. This trend continued well into the 20th century. From 1967 to 1988, the U.S. dog and cat population as a percentage of the human population rose from 22% to almost 50%. Animals make better companions when we see them as individuals instead of just as laborers or useful tools, and this recognition of individuality could be the key factor in the expanding moral circle. Surveys in the past half century indicate that rural residents, who are more likely to live with animals for their labor instead of companionship, show less affection for animals and less concern about their mistreatment. Rural pet owners instead focus on the animal's practical and material value. A 2001 study suggested that greater childhood pet attachment was associated with vegetarianism and negative feelings about eating animal products, likely due to increased empathy for animals. Globalization and feminization. Concern for animals might also partly result as a spillover from our concern for other humans. If we live in a society that rejects human-on-human violence, the similarities to human-on-animal violence might lead to opposition by analogy. Over time, our increasingly globalized society has widened our circle of compassion from family and neighbors to other villages, then to other cultures and societies. In The Better Angels of Our Nature, psychologist Steven Pinker makes a compelling case that human-on-human violence has overall declined in the course of human history. He discusses several explanations. The majority of them involve mutual benefits, and therefore don't seem to apply much to human-on-animal violence, such as the increase in international trade over the centuries that has made war more costly. But two explanations seem quite plausible. Cosmopolitanism, also known as globalization, the blending of cultures and perspectives through increasing connections around the world, and feminization, the increasing power of women who tend to be less violent than men. These seem especially important when we consider psychologically distant animals like those in farms and slaughterhouses. As our society globalizes, we connect with people very different from us through social media, news, traveling, and other mediums. This connection and the increased compassion as a result of feminization sets precedent for a general expansion of our moral circle. As Pinker notes, our increasing concern for animals is a particularly strong reason for optimism that the general trend in violence will continue downwards in the future. Animals have been unable to take political action of their own against their oppressors. Animals are not voiceless, but their cries for help are easier to ignore, and they lack the ability to organize and protest in our political system. This makes them dependent on humanity's ethical choices. Religious trends. While some researchers argue that the world is becoming less religious, the main world religions have nonetheless exerted substantial influence over human morality for millennia. In 1888, Mohandas Gandhi moved from his native India to London for law school. While in London, he maintained a vegetarian diet in accordance with his Hindu beliefs, and picked up a copy of Henry Salt's book, A Plea for Vegetarianism, at a local vegetarian restaurant. Inspired, Gandhi joined the London Vegetarian Society and was elected to its executive committee in 1891. That same year, he graduated, traveling back to India and then on to South Africa. Although no longer in London, Gandhi continued to endorse vegetarianism and strongly oppose animal cruelty. With his rise as a world-famous activist for civil rights and India's independence, vegetarianism in Western society gained social credibility and a strong association with nonviolence and ethical living. Gandhi is just one manifestation of the religious forces that might have played key roles in the increasing compassion for animals in Western civilization. A religion even more sympathetic to vegetarianism than Hinduism is Jainism, which takes a remarkably broad approach to nonviolence. In addition to not eating animals, its followers avoid plants that grow underground, such as carrots and onions. This is because the harvesting of these plants requires the loss of the plant's life, while harvesting above-ground plants, such as corn, can allow the plant to continue living. The first of the five precepts of Buddhism asks followers to undertake the training to avoid taking the life of beings. Taken literally, this might commit a practitioner to vegetarianism because buying and eating animal products requires animals to be killed, although usually the killing is done by someone else. In practice, Buddhist vegetarianism varies by location and denomination, but vegetarianism is generally more prevalent among Buddhists than among non-practitioners. As Western societies feel more of a pull from these religions, indicated by the increasing prevalence of practices like yoga and Eastern martial arts, this could bring them closer to adopting ideologies of nonviolence. Even the Beatles were compelled to change, visiting India in 1968 to study meditation under a famous yogi, who served as the band's spiritual advisor. All four musicians went vegetarian at various points in their lives. Outside of the popularity of specific religions, the movement away from religion, or at least certain forms of it, could be a contributing factor. Religious notions of animals as manifestations of emotions, spirits, and other one-dimensional forces lead us to idolize some species, demonize others, and sometimes do both for the same population. In Native American stories, which were an important part of my own upbringing, the wolf stood as the wise, kind, and honest foil for his trickster coyote brother. The loyalty and camaraderie of wolves is held up as an example for children to emulate, and you never hear of a wolf or coyote who deviated from these predestined roles. In Christian scripture, wolves are sometimes seen as symbols of greed and destruction, challenging noble shepherds and their flocks. The movement away from these one-dimensional concepts could be enabling us to better appreciate animals' individualities in a way we could not when they were seen as unchanging representations of emotions and other intangible ideas. Arguably, some religions even explicitly diminish the moral value of animals. A famous Bible verse states, "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." The word dominion is frequently cited as a reason for doing anything we want to animals because they are categorically lower in value than humanity. However, many Christians today see this verse more as a statement of stewardship and responsibility rather than superiority. In other parts of the Bible, it's suggested that God requires animal sacrifices, though to be fair, it's suggested elsewhere that God dislikes animal sacrifices. Similar conflicts are seen in other religions. In a perhaps surprising Hindu practice, some followers gather every 5 years at a Nepalese temple to participate in the brutal sacrifice of hundreds of thousands of animals, hacking away at them with machetes and other cruel implements. Only since 2015 has there been a sign of hope for an end to this outdated violence, as heavy international pressure was put on the devotees to cancel the practice indefinitely. It remains to be seen if animal sacrifice will resume at the temple. Whether as a result of an alteration or a decrease in religiosity, people are slowly growing to appreciate that animals are complex biological creatures made of the same flesh and blood that we are, not simply manifestations and tools for our own ideologies. Moving forward,